Welcome back. You're listening to the Healthy Aging Show, and we are featuring a rebroadcast of one of our earlier shows this year. We hope you enjoy it. We have a guest today via the telephone, Dr. Arthur Yee. He is the chief of infectious diseases at Norwalk Hospital, and he's also the director of infection control within the hospital to make sure that whatever happens that grows out of the hospital is quickly taken care of. He's also in private practice with the Norwalk Medical Group. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Yee.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, as I explained to you, my interest in this came up a few weeks ago through personal experience. To make the story as short as possible, I had a small break in the skin of my index finger, which kind of hurt for a couple of days, and then started to develop into an infection and then eventually a blood blister. And coincidentally, I was getting things like severe chills and body aches that I thought was the onset of the flu. Not thinking that the two were related, I treated the symptoms and put a bandage on the finger. And it was the very astute friend of mine who's a nurse looked at me and said, your symptoms are not consistent with the flu and your finger looks like something that came out of a horror movie. I think you should go to the hospital because I think you have cellulitis. And I'd never heard the term. And I went to the hospital and sure enough, they diagnosed it as that and treated me with antibiotics. But I was completely oblivious of the threat that I was dealing with. That's what prompted me to want to discuss this on the show because it's something that many people might ignore until it was too late.
Dr. Yee, how common is cellulitis?
Cellulitis is actually one of the more common diagnoses we see in the hospital, especially through the emergency room. And the story that was just told is very common. It happens in the community where people develop flu-like symptoms and they naturally attribute to the flu. And then they could go on to develop something much more serious underlying. Now, with all these serious infections, they pretty much present very similar in the beginning with flu-like symptoms. But what separates the flu from some of these more serious conditions is that the symptoms usually progress more rapidly, and they tend to be more intense in terms of symptoms. So the story that was just told is very common for us to hear in the emergency room. And whether a patient develops an infection that's mild or moderate or severe is really a complex interaction between the host and the actual infectious agent. For example, back in 1995, about 15 years ago, we actually saw the first two cases of necrotizing fasciitis in the state of Connecticut. I don't know if you remember those cases back 15 years ago, but these two cases followed about 13 cases that were reported out of England. And necrotizing fasciitis is really the most serious complication of what may start off as cellulitis. So a lot of these infections occur in the spectrum.
Is that the flesh-eating disease?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And most infectious diseases occur in a spectrum. You can have something very, very mild, like the common cold, which can be very mild, without fevers. You can have a sore throat, feel a little tired, feel a little achy, to something really severe with the virus, which is influenza, seasonal influenza, and I think you all know about the H1N1,
right?
What kind of damage that can do. I mean, that's the severest type of viral flu-like infection. But like with any infection, even cellulitis, it can be very mild, where people can develop a little, you know, cut or a break in the skin. They can develop a little redness. You take care of it with soap and water and some local antibiotic cream, and it may go away. Or, if you're unlucky, if you got infected with a very virulent, very pathogenic bacteria, like what causes necrotizing fasciitis, it's going to actually hurt you, and it can hurt you pretty quickly. So whether a patient develops a mild type of infection or severe type of infection really involves the complex interaction between the host, if your immune system is strong or not, and also how virulent the bug is. So even though you may have a very strong immune system, if you're unfortunate to get a very pathogenic or very, you know, bad, strong bug, you can still develop a bad infection.
Well, you know, this was, for several reasons, I was dismissing this, obviously, because of the other symptoms and the confusion with the flu. Mm. But I've had cuts on my hands. I'm a woodworker, and I'm always doing something. It didn't happen that I was doing anything at the time, so I wasn't sure where this originated, but I've had an infection on my finger, and using an ointment or some topical application, it tended to go away. But I was under a very stressful period, and
yeah.
I believe that my immune system had probably been compromised, and that could have assisted whatever it was that I contracted to progress as quickly as it did.
Now, where would you have encountered this?
Well, the bugs are actually on your skin. It's really your own skin bacteria, so that, as you know, your surface of your body is not sterile. There's bacteria there. So whenever there's a break in the skin, it provides a portal of entry for the bacteria that's lying on the skin to go through that cut or break in the skin underneath the top layer of your skin, which is called the epidermis, and it goes right below there. It goes right into your subcutaneous tissue, which is more the fat tissue, so to speak, and it spreads very rapidly. And if it's really pathogenic or very virulent, it goes into your bloodstream that can cause a really serious blood infection.
Now, can this be a precursor to something like going septic?
Oh, absolutely. That's what septic means.
Okay.
It means that once the bacteria gets into your bloodstream, it can cause high fevers, a high pulse rate, a low blood pressure, which can cause you to feel dizzy, nauseous, and just feel outright terrible and horrible. And that's a warning signal.
Well, I'm sure that you've seen a lot of cases, but I became very sensitized to this, and I had a lot of respect for it when she said that it could be cellulitis. I have a good friend of mine whose husband was recovering from lymphoma, and he was on the mend and really doing very well, and he died in 3 days of septic shock.
Yeah.
And, you know, it came out of nowhere.
Yeah, these can happen very quickly, and what cellulitis means is that it means an inflammation or infection of the cells of your skin. So just like tonsillitis means infection, inflammation of your tonsils, and appendicitis means inflammation of your appendix, cellulitis refers to inflammation and infection of your skin, and that infection can go deeper toward the blood, and then you become septic, and you can literally die. I mean, literally, cellulitis can become necrotizing fasciitis very quickly, literally within a day. And people can get sick very quickly and possibly lose a limb and possibly lose their life. So what we usually recommend patients to do is if they cut themselves and it just doesn't feel right, it doesn't look right, it's always better to have it checked out, because the best thing you're told is that it's nothing to worry about, go home, take care of it. But obviously, if it's a warning sign for something more serious, time is of essence. What makes the most difference is when we get to the patient in terms of treatment. The earlier we get to the patient's infection, the much more likely they'll be able to respond quickly and successfully.
Well, that was the interesting part of this, and that's why I felt it was so urgent that we needed to bring this to everyone's attention, because I was told that I would have just gone home, gone to bed, and ridden out the symptoms, and very likely I wouldn't have been ambulatory to go to the hospital on my own the next day. I might have to go by ambulance.
It's very possible that could have happened, and we see this so commonly where patients come to the emergency room and they think it's nothing, and for the most time it probably will not be anything serious, but for that one time it is serious, you can't turn the clock back, obviously.
Well, if someone thinks that they've contracted some kind of an infection, are there any home applications that they should undertake, and when should they ultimately make that trip to the emergency room?
Well, for certain, if they start developing what we call systemic symptoms, which means involving symptoms outside of that area which is involved, such as either nausea or dizziness or feeling feverish or certainly having a fever, that's already made that process go beyond at the local site.
Okay.
So whenever you have those symptoms, absolutely should, if not call your doctor, certainly come to the emergency room.
My concern, Dr. Yi, is the exposure so easily out when I'm using an ATM machine, I might be hanging onto a railing, walking down a staircase. How best to continue preventing this disease from it? Or any disease at this point.
Yeah. Well, the best advice I can give to your listening public is to stay away from whoever might be coughing at least 3 feet away. And if you can do 6 feet, it's even better, because aerosolized droplets that contain a lot of these infectious agents that people cough generally don't travel more than 3 to 6 feet away. So if you're caught in a situation in the room where you have somebody coughing, at least, even though you may not be able to leave the room, at least try to stay at least 3 to 6 feet away from these people. Ideally, if you can not inhale too many times in the presence of these people, maybe slow your respiratory rate down, that would also help too, because the way we acquire these infections is by inhaling through our respiratory tract, through our nose or mouth. The aerosolized droplets that these infectious people spew out into the environment, and when we inhale it, that's how it enters our respiratory tract.
Okay, now that's assuming that we're able to stand in an open field 6 feet apart.
Right.
What happens when we're on an airplane 6 inches apart?
Or the Metro North.
Well, I think the best way to handle that would be if you can get one of those masks to put over your mouth. I've actually asked some of my patients who are frequent flyers in airplanes to do that. When they've done that, they've actually had a significantly decreased risk of infection, you know, after their trip.
Right.
Because what it does, it filters out many of the aerosolized droplets that they could have inhaled freely anyway through their respiratory tract.
And I think people are looking less oddly at people that wear masks these days. And
it's becoming fashionable.
In some countries, like Japan, it's quite common that people wear masks in public areas.
You probably see designer masks before too long with all kinds of fancy
embroidery
and everything.
Probably
that
will.
Might be a look of the future, actually.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's,
there you go, John. There's a whole new product line.
The scarf in the wintertime.
Right.
But with all the touching that happens with an ATM machine while you're shopping or using your credit card,
well, technology has made use of the fingers on surfaces much more necessary.
Yeah, we just recommend frequent hand washing with soap and water, making sure that you leave the soap on your hands for at least 20 seconds before you rinse off. And the reason I say that is because it takes that long to effectively kill the bacteria on your skin and just below your skin surface. 20% of your skin bacteria actually live below your skin surface in sweat gland and hair follicle crypts. So if you quickly wash with soap and don't leave it on for that long, you're not getting into that 20% of the bacteria that lives below your skin surface, so you may not be killing those bacteria. At least 20 seconds we recommend leaving the soap on your skin before rinsing, yes.
With travel so prevalent, with so many people coming particularly to the United States, but in any country, we've become a melting pot of cultures and ethnic groups that there are different slants on both hygiene and their customs. We encourage people to cough into the crook of their elbow. Do other countries do that, or do they hand wash as frequently as we would like them to do coming to this country? There was a study that we saw in Britain where they tested, I guess there were roadside rest stops, and they had 200,000 occurrences where they measured the amount of hand washing, and it was terribly dismal. Nobody but maybe a third of the people washed their hands, and even less washed it with soap.
Now, Dr. Yi, we are seeing, as Dennis is stating, we are so global as a society. How are you positioning for the future? What do you see maybe coming and with the situations that we've had, clearly with tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes? We have certainly more people coming to the country. Is there other situations with the infections that we need to be even more diligent?
That's one of the things that's one of the most difficult things to predict. Just like this past fall and, you know, wintertime, we were preparing for an onslaught of H1N1 virus spread and possibly an epidemic. And we haven't really seen at all anywhere near the amount of cases we were expecting. Now, that could be because our public marketing campaign of getting people vaccinated was so good that when cases do occur in the community, they didn't have a chance to spread because people were well vaccinated. So it's really hard to predict in the future, you know, what disease may be coming away and how long it's going to be lasting. For example, as you probably remember, the SARS virus, this was many years ago, where it was predicted by the CDC and many other health experts that it was going to really devastate populations in countries, especially in countries where they were originally describing, which is Asia. And as you know, the SARS virus just sort of fell off the earth. We didn't hear about it just suddenly. So the prediction part is really difficult, partly because of what we call viral drift, which means that viruses change in different ways, either for the worse or for the better, and then they become much more benign, and we don't see them anymore clinically. I think the basic thing we try to encourage in this country is just practicing basic infection control practices, which is, as you alluded to before, covering your mouth when you cough into the elbow area or the corner of your arm area. and really frequent hand washing and trying to minimize any closeness to anybody, that you should stay away from them by at least 3 to 6 feet so you don't catch something.
A lot of it's just common sense.
Common sense is exactly right.
Any suggestions for nutrition or in the situation where you are in a stressful environment?
Compromised immunity.
Compromised ways to...
There's two things we recommend strongly for, you know, bolstering your immune system. One is hydration. One of the things I'll mention is that I find in Fairfield County that people are so busy going about their ways that they forget to stay well hydrated. And when you don't stay well hydrated, one has to understand that the reason why we have a good immune system is that our white blood cells, which acts as our pillar of defense, has to be delivered to your respiratory tract so that when you inhale a virus or bacteria, those white blood cells are circulated up to your respiratory tract. So when they get exposed to the virus or the bacteria, those white cells end up effectively neutralizing right at the mucosal surface, which is the lining of your mouth or your nose. If you're not very well hydrated, that circulation of white blood cells to those areas is not as efficient, and therefore you don't transit or bring those white cells there efficiently enough. So when the virus or bacteria comes into your respiratory tract, your immune system is weakened there, and then it establishes itself, the infection. That's the first thing. The second thing is to try to minimize stress at all possible, because studies have shown that stress does adversely affect how your white blood cells work. So that if you're under stress, if your white cells, even though they're brought there with hydration to your respiratory tract, they may not work as well when you're under stress. And what we recommend for that is just regular exercising, which really helps a lot in terms of your immune system being stronger. When you exercise, it makes you feel less stressed so that you feel better and your immune system works better. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal in January 5th, 2010 edition, in the personal journal section, that talks about the benefit of exercising, especially in how it helps your immune system.
Wall Street Journal has a lot of good articles like that. Just people have to read them.
Right.
And certainly the winter season, individuals do not hydrate as much as they should.
That's correct. And we recommend they strongly pay attention to that. And I just want to mention also that alcohol and caffeinated drinks dehydrate you, because caffeine and alcohol are diuretic, which means they make you diarrhea, so you lose fluid that way. So when we say hydration, we're talking about water and non-caffeinated, non-alcoholic drinks. And we do recommend at least about a half a gallon to 3/4 gallon, which is 3 quarts of fluid a day, not counting caffeinated or alcoholic drinks, minimum. If you're very active and busy and exercise regularly, the daily intake should be more than that.
So we're talking about juices, we're talking about obviously water, sport drinks.
Right.
Not necessarily soda.
Right. No Coca-Cola with caffeine in it, Mountain Dew, iced tea, coffee, alcohol. Those are going to dehydrate you.
Okay. We're going to stop right now and take a break, and then we're going to come back on the other side because we've got so much more that we want to talk to you about. We'll be right back after a slight break, and we're talking to Dr. Arthur Yee about infectious diseases. Be right back.
Dr. Yee, my concern is...
No.
Oh, that's right. You're the host.
I'm the host.
You're the host.
You shut up until I tell you to talk.
Gracie, be quiet.
One demerit for the new co-host.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
All right. Are we ready?
Go ahead, man.
All right. Welcome back. You're listening to the Healthy Aging Show, and we're talking to Dr. Arthur Yee, Chief of Infectious Diseases for Norwalk Hospital. What role does age play in affecting the ability for someone to infect or to receive infectious disease?
The older one is, the more likely you are to be susceptible to infection, and it's purely because of the aging of the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
As we age, the immune system gets weaker, and we see that reflected in why shingles is much more common as we get older, because shingles is adult chickenpox. It's chickenpox that you had when you were a little child.
Yeah, some of us know that very well, don't we, John?
I finally got chickenpox last year at the age of 44.
Yeah. Wait,
and we have pictures of it. It's cute.
So when you get shingles, it's a reactivation of chickenpox, and that's because your immune system starts to get weak, and it's purely a function of aging quite often. So yes, you're more susceptible to infection when you get older. And can you be more contagious when you're older and spread the infection? The answer is probably yes, in the sense that if you're more susceptible to it, you're going to be more likely harboring the infectious agent, so you could in turn be more contagious.
Now, is it true that the germs of a child are stronger than those of an adult?
It depends on what germ you're talking about. So as a general statement, it depends on what specific germ you're talking about.
Okay, because that was something that I've heard so often, but you're right. It's got to be germ specific.
Right.
But in the same token, being older has some advantages with some of the diseases as well. perhaps more resistance.
Yeah, you're smarter. But
right. Well, smart enough to stay away.
The perfect example is that with this H1N1 virus, mm-hmm. the older people have lived through outbreaks in 1957 and 1977, so they do have partial immunity to this virus. So in that situation, the older you are, it's more likely you do have immunity to some of the old viruses you were exposed to many years ago.
Okay. So you're not only smart, you're immune.
Well, I had one other comment, too, as far as the medication and finishing your prescription, and not and the, many of us.
Well, the importance of doing that, because every time you get a prescription, you're told, finish the prescription as prescribed. What are the risks of not doing that?
The risk of not doing that would be, one, your infection may relapse, and two, you could be facilitating or breeding resistant bacteria in your body by not finishing your prescription.
So it would make it harder to combat later on.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. I have all kinds of personal experiences, but I had Lyme disease, and it was undertreated, and I had it 2 years. And eventually it took a whole month of intravenous antibiotics to finally get rid of it. And I consider myself probably lucky for that.
And finishing your medication with the cellulitis.
Finish your peas, carrots, your amoxicillin.
Even if you feel better.
All right. Dr. Yee, we really want to thank you for taking the time and coming on to talk about this, letting our listeners know the importance of infectious disease. Unfortunately, we've got so much we could talk about, but we kind of ran short of time, but I think we covered most of the topics. We want to invite our listeners to come back and listen again, and if you think that Dawn did a good enough job that she should return, you can call us on our 1-800
microphone hogging here.
Well, thank you very much,
Dr.
Yee.
Please subscribe, recommend, and visit our website, healthyagingshow.com. Thanks for joining us at the Healthy Aging Show.